So, as I was saying, I would like to show you how you can build a black hole in your bathroom and observe some of its effects. In fact, I will, the one I would like to discuss is the superagence effect of rotating black hole. You don't see anything, doesn't matter. So the whole idea started with an analogy that was discovered by Unruh back in the 80s. So he actually realized something quite interesting is that if you consider wave propagating around a black hole, they propagate in exactly the same way as a sound wave, for example, in a moving fluid. So what do I mean by this? It's the analogy is quite simple. In fact, so here there is a show and a cross stick. So here is a schematic picture of, so imagine a river, and this river is flowing faster and faster. And if you're on this region, the current of the water is very slow, so you can send wave in any direction you like. And then it starts accelerating in this direction, and at some point the current of the water is higher than the propagation speed of the wave. And so if you want to emit wave from this point, it's actually dragged by the current and it cannot escape to this direction. So this limit here acts as a horizon for sound wave or water wave. And waves are trapped inside this region. So this point here is sort of analogous to a horizon. And in fact, it's more than simply a nice hand-weaving analogy. It's, if you work out the math, you realize that the wave equation that describes the propagation of this wave gets deformed by an advection term, so by the presence of this velocity. In fact, this deformation is exactly the same as the wave equation in a curved background described by this metric, and the velocity field of the fluid, and also the local speed of the wave, which can change also with the position, these describe a certain geometry. And you can analyze this geometry with a standard tool, and you realize that indeed what we just said, that namely when the current velocity v is equal to the propagation speed c, you have a horizon, a Keeling horizon or event horizon. So it's really like the acoustic version of black hole. And this works also if you have, so this is the one-dimensional analogy, but you could do this in two dimensions with a rotating and a draining flow. So imagine that here it's accelerating, but it's also rotating and draining. And if the total velocity exceeds the speed of the wave, then you force this wave to co-rotate. So this is the analogous to the ergo region of a black hole. And if instead it's the radial flow only that surpasses the speed of waves, then you're really trapped inside a radius. And this is the analogous to the horizon. And because you have you can reproduce the same geometrical structure as a black hole, then the most known effect of black hole should be reproducible in these fluids. What is quite nice with this analogy is that because it relies on very few ingredients, I'm just using the wave equation and how it gets deformed by the medium of propagation having a flow, you can recover this analogy in many different setups, in many different media. So, for example, you could do this in classical fluids like sound wave, surface wave, but also in very low temperature fluid where you can hope to observe and describe a quantum effect, so that, for example, Bose-Einstein condensates. And although the original idea of Unruh is quite old, in fact, in the recent years, there have been a lot of experimental progresses. So many groups are now doing experiments using these ideas, and we have had a few very interesting results, both in classical settings, using water wave, for instance, or in optical fibers, or in Bose-Einstein condensates. There are more and more results coming. So let me get back a little bit to sort of the historical motivation, in fact, of Unruh himself in the first paper. So you all know that if you consider a black hole and you look at how a radiation propagates and you take into account quantum effects, radiation around a black hole will emit spontaneously a radiation with in a thermal state, a thermal spectrum. So this is the discovery of Hawking in the 70s. And it's a very important discovery for its relation with black hole entropy, and also so several aspects of quantum gravity, because it's a quantum effect. So it's a key prediction of black hole physics. But however, it relies on a specific set of assumptions, namely that you have a radiation field on a classical gravitational background. And there are a few issues, and in particular, there is one question that arises if you look at how this Hawking particle, low energy particles that you detect, where they are coming from. So if you trace them back, because there is a huge redshift close to horizon, they actually come from quantum fluctuations that have an energy, as measured in a free falling frame, an energy that is very high. In fact, if we put a few numbers in it, for example, after a solar mass black hole, you wait for 1 second, this low energy frequency that you're detecting is related to the co-moving frequency, the free falling frequency of the quantum fluctuation by a factor exponential 10 to the 5. So this is ridiculously high. And it means that even though you detect very low energy, so it seems that the approximation of a semi-classical background is fine, it seems that maybe you're actually doing some assumption about microphysics and actually energy. And this relates to energy that is much higher than the Planck scale. So you have to. It seems that you're making assumptions about Planck scale physics close to the horizon to derive this result. So this point raises the question now, does it make sense? I mean, does this Hawking effect rely on and depends on whatever is actually going on in the microphysics at the Planck scale, or not? Or is it really a low energy phenomenon for a large black hole, of course? So this is a question. And when Biluna wrote this paper, he actually immediately realized that one of the interesting thing of this analogy is that in the fluid, we know what the microscopic theory is. It's just the Schrodinger equation for 10 to the 23 atoms. And you can at least try to address this question in this setup. How is it resolved in this particular setup? And he asked this question in the very first paper without having the answer to it. And so again, here you take a fluid, you ask the same question. If you have the analog of the Hawking effect, it should come from near horizon fluctuation or waves that have a very short wavelength, and therefore they will probe the physics that happens at short distance. And it was realized by Tate Jacobson that the first deviation from the analogy from this wave equation in a curved background would be that you start deviating from the relativistic dispersion relation, the relation between the frequency and the momentum. And in fact, or said differently, when you go to short wavelength, at some point you will have a change in the propagation speed of this wave, and you will leave the regime of the analogy. So here, lambda is a new. Is it frequency here? Yeah, it's a. Yeah, it's a frequency scale or energy scale, and below this new scale here, you see the analogy, the long wavelength physics, all right? And when you start having going close to this energy scale, you see these deviations, okay? So in a fluid, it depends on the specific fluid. This is given by the physics of the fluid. For example, I mean, what he suggested in the first place was for sound wave. For sound wave, for example, these are waves which are very few, not dispersive, almost not dispersive, so that would be their interatomic scale, for example. Or in Bose-Einstein condensate, exactly this is. At long wavelength, you see this analogy, and when you start being at the scale of the interatomic scale, you start seeing that this background is no longer a fluid, a continuous fluid, but it's actually made of discretized atoms. And it's exactly how it will manifest itself, at least at first, perturbatively. Yes?
So how about dissipation?
Yeah, dissipation.
Hydrodynamics predicts that the energy scale of water is k, dissipation scale is k squared.
Sure. In fact, for sound wave in air, the dissipation will show up before this, but for most fluid, it's actually this that is the first effect that you encounter. Yeah, but I mean, the thing is, once you have this kind of effect, because you break local Lorentz invariance, you will all the time, you will necessarily have dissipation. But the main point is that in most fluid, and in particular in quantum fluid, the first deviation that you will see is this one. And it's and then the question was, now if you take into account this, which sort of regulates what happens close to the horizon, is the Hawking effect robust? Is it maintained? And there have been a lot of theoretical work to understand the effect of this dispersion on the Hawking effect. And the answer is mainly yes, under a reasonable set of assumption, despite the fact that you have to take into account this to describe fully the phenomenon. In the effect itself is there, and it's insensitive to this scale, typically, and to what happens at short distance physics. And this is true theoretically, but you can also make experiment where the nice thing about experiment is that on the same time you're testing everything. You're taking into account dissipation, nonlinearities, whatever is present in the system, because it's a real system. And then you can make an experiment to try to test this effect, and there have been a few nice results. So for example, in water wave, you can do the classical pendant of the Hawking effect, which very simply is if you, instead of looking at the spontaneous channel, the spontaneous emission, you look at stimulated emission. So you send something in and you trigger this effect, and you can check that the relation between what you send and what comes out satisfies the thermal law, essentially. But you can also try to observe this in effect. So these are, maybe it wasn't clear, but these are our results that was obtained experimentally in this paper. So our experiment that was conducted. And actually, maybe I should mention something quite nice, is that the first paper that was done by actually Unruh himself and other people in Silke Weinfurtner, which I work now, they did this stimulated version. But a slight improvement was made in France 2 years ago, where they don't send anything. They just use ambient noise as a trigger. So they don't have to send anything, they just use ambient noise. And in fact, it's in some sense closer to the Hawking effect, because it's in the Hawking effect, the noise that triggers the effect is simply quantum fluctuations. Of course, here it's classical, but it's a bit closer. And now, if you want to really go and observe the effect triggered by quantum fluctuation, you have to go in quantum fluids. So some result has been obtained in Bose-Einstein condensate quite recently. So it seems that we do have the signature of the spontaneous emission of this. But there are many open questions that remains in the setup, because of course they are never ideal, and although the mechanism seems to work, there are a few questions that are unanswered. For example, in water wave, they could sort of they could observe the mechanism, but the spectrum, in fact the thermality of the spectrum, is harder to prove, and this is still sort of not fully understood, both theoretically and experimentally, if you take into account what happens precisely in this medium.
Yeah? So do people simulate this just using Navier-Stokes?
I don't think anyone has really made numerical simulation of the full Navier-Stokes equation for this. There have been a lot of numerical work, but it's all if you can already model the system by linearized waves on top of a certain flow.
But you don't know of anyone that's just run a fluid simulation of this?
No.
Because I had an undergrad do it like 10 years ago, but...
Doing this?
We didn't publish it. Okay.
And what happened?
It reproduced the water wave, and you send a wave in, and then it gets amplified, and it comes out, and it's just...
That's interesting.
One of the questions that people often have is which elements of the effect that you're seeing actually have something to do with quantum physics, right? Which one of the classical waves?
Yeah, yeah,
so
that's
more than that? Like if you say there's a quantum Hawking effect, how do we, what is the physics that tells us that there's really quantum physics?
There are sort of two set question, I think. It's first, what is this classical effect has to do with the Hawking effect? And the second is, if you are in a quantum settings, how can you check that it's actually quantum mechanics that is producing this? So let me answer the second one, because it's what I wanted to say about the second line, is what you can show, and what another quite nice feature of experiment of these analog black holes is that you can actually go inside the black hole and look for it. So what you could do is you can go inside the black hole and look for the correlation between what you observe on this side and what you observe inside. And you can, I mean, at least theoretically, you have criterion, which are sort of Bell-like inequalities, that you can show that the correlation between the two are really explained only by being in a quantum state. No classical. So of course, in this experiment in water, they are classically correlated. Right, because you have classical noise. But now the aim, which seems to, at least in the result of Steinauer, it seems that he has observed this violation of classical inequalities, which should prove that the pair of the Hawking particle and its partner are entangled. And this is really the quantum future of this. Right? So I guess I answer half of your question. But now, so that was sort of the introduction. But what I would like to discuss today is a different direction that you can take in this analogy by studying black holes in these fluids. And actually black hole, but not only black hole, I mean studying some gravitational systems. So for example, another nice analogy that you can make, because you can mimic curved space-time, you can also have a fluid where you vary some parameter with time. And with this, you can mimic the expansion of the universe and look for the physics of the early universe, pair production and entanglement, and so on. So this is also studied in Bose-Einstein condensate, for example. Although in this setup, no entanglement has ever been detected. And then you can also look at higher dimensional flow. So all what I mentioned so far, it was just for one dimensional channel of fluid flowing in one direction. But of course, you can do this in higher dimension and have a more new effects, and in particular, due to the effects that are due to rotation. This is actually what I will focus on now, is if you have rotation, you have an effect that can happen around black hole, which is superradiance. And superradiance is actually closely related to the Hawking effect, because it's superradiance is a consequence, it's a direct implication of black hole thermodynamics. So you cannot have the Hawking effect and not superradiance. So it's one of its consequences that we're mimicking and observing in our experiment. And I would like also to mention another direction that we find interesting, which is a bit further away from the Hawking effect, but very important for black hole physics, which is the ring down of black holes, so this quasi-normal mode frequencies. When you perturb a black hole, it would oscillate with a certain frequency, a characteristic of the geometry. And this is what we... that's unexpected. I think it's just my computer. No, Mr. Simon, it's my computer. My computer is a bit old, and sometimes it does this. T'es sûr? Tu crois que c'est le truc?
Ouais, mais en principe, il y a eu une cap directe qui a été mise. Je prends la 30.
Quoi?
Je prends la 30.
Ça marche? Bah, je sais pas, mais si c'est pas. Non, l'ordi ça va aller, hein. C'est juste. C'est... Quoi? J'ai YouPorn qui est... Ah! All right. Anyway, I was making the transition now to what I would like to focus on today is to present this experiment that we did on the observation of this super radiance in a vortex flow. So what we use is water draining a hole, and we send wave, and we explore how they look like, how it looks like the physics of a black hole. And we're interested in super radiance. So let me first present what super radiance is. So this is a schematic drawing of a black hole. Here you have a horizon, and this ellipse here is the Auger region. So if you're in this white region in between, you can escape the black hole, but you are forced to co-rotate. And in particular, there is a specific effect that happens here, is that you can have negative energy, as observed by an asymptotic observer. And because of this, so Penrose understood that you can send an object in this region, then split it into two parts, and if this process is done in the right way, one part will leave with negative energy, falls into the hole, and the other part will escape from the black hole with more energy than it came in with. So by doing this process, you can mine energy, you can extract energy from a black hole just by exploiting the physics of the ergo region. And this is, again, because you can have negative energy in the ergo region. So in GR, it's because the Killing field dt becomes actually space-like in this region. But in a flow, it's quite interesting to understand what it means to have negative energy. It means that if you excite correctly waves in this region, they can have negative energy in a sense that they lower the energy of the full system, the flow plus the waves, instead of what you would expect, that they increase the total energy. And because of this, you can and super radiance is simply the wave version of this process. So you send a wave in the correct manner, it propagates, it scatters, and waves, well, they can separate into several pieces, like a transmission and a reflection wave, reflected wave. And if you do it the right way, you will have the same phenomenon, namely that the wave come out with more energy than it came in with. If you check this, you see that this can be realized under the super radiant condition, which is that the frequency of the wave you send has to be low enough. It has to be smaller than m. So m is the azimuthal number of a wave, so when you send wave with a certain rotation. And omega is a rotation, the angular velocity of the black hole horizon. And if you have small frequency, so you see that you have sort of two conditions hidden in there. First, m, the rotation has to be positive. That means the wave rotates with the black hole. And second, the frequency has to be low enough. So this is usually, if you have this condition for an azimuthal wave, you have super radiance. So we want to do this for water wave. So water waves, they're simply excitation of the surface of a water tank. So you have water in a with a certain depth, and you make little perturbation out of the free surface, and this perturbation will propagate following a certain dynamics, which is characterized by the dispersion relation, which gives you the relation between the frequency and the momentum, and in particular gives you the propagation speed. And the reason why I show you this dispersion relation, is you see that it's significantly more complicated than what you would expect in GR in a relativistic system, because you have a lot of dispersion, as I already mentioned. But for shallow water, if the wavelength of these waves is much longer than the depth, then what you see is essentially an effective spacetime, or in other words, you have a relativistic-like dispersion relation. All right. So because at least in this regime, it looks like a space, water can look like a spacetime, you should be able to reproduce the same effects. And it has been studied if you look at water rotating and draining through a hole, and you can check that it has an effective metric, which displays super radiance as expected. So for example, the simplest model, just to fix the ideas. So you imagine a two-dimensional flow, it's draining to the center. This is the velocity field. It has a radial drain. It's negative because it's drained towards the center. and it has an angular part. So this specific form of 1/1/r is obtained if you assume a two-dimensional flow, which is maximally symmetric. You see that because it's incompressible, the radial part has to look this has to have this form, and because it's an irrotational, if you consider an irrotational vortex, the only solution is this one. All right, so at least for shallow water, on these types of vortex, you should observe superradiance. Yeah, at least theoretically, it's exactly what was realized. So the intensity of the debit of the drain will give you the location of an analog horizon, and the angular part, of course, will give you the specific radius of the ergo region. So, and under the same condition, as you expect. So of course these are very, 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 very simple models, and they're a bit far from actual water. So, at the theoretical level, there are many questions that you can still try to address, which is how this gets modified if you have a more realistic vortex flow, and in particular, if you take into account this more complicated dispersion relation, how does it affect it? Although it should not affect, in principle, there is no reason why it should rely only on this shallow water dispersion relation, but of course it will modify, and it's not really known exactly how. But for what is interesting for us is that we can, instead of solving the theoretical problem, we can just do the experiment and check if it works. So for this, let me explain just very simply how it works. Well, you consider the general case of waves scattering on this bathtub. So this is a picture of what an azimuthal wave looks like. It's just a spiral wave with a certain rotation, and M is the number of branches. All right, so it has this specific form. And if you have a flow that is symmetric under rotation, then you can separate any solution, any wave can be decomposed into a superposition of these types of waves. And this will exploit this after. But assuming that you send such a wave, you excite such a rotational wave, it rotates, it goes into the center, it interacts with the hole, and then it comes out. So when you do this decomposition, you look at the radial profile of the wave at fixed frequency and azimuthal number, it decomposes into an ingoing part that goes toward the center, an outgoing one, with certain amplitude, and the ratio between these two amplitudes is what I call the reflection coefficient. And now the game is to show that under some condition, this reflection coefficient can be bigger than one, which shows that you have extracted energy from the flow or from the analog black hole. So just if you use these simple theoretical models that I mentioned before, just to have an idea of how it should look like, what we observe. So for example, this is when you fixed omega and you look at the different values of m, all right? And you see that usually it's low values of m and positive that will be amplified. Well, negative values of m, so again, when you rotate with the flow, you can be amplified. But if you rotate against the flow, then you will be absorbed. Most of the energy is absorbed by the hole. And these are typical spectrum if you vary in frequency. So remember that you have to satisfy this condition. So at low frequency, you can see that m equal 1 is essentially amplified. Then you increase the frequency, m equal 1 is no longer amplified, but m equal 2 can be amplified. So depending on the frequency, it's not the same mode that will be amplified. And you see also, I don't know if you read well or well, but these are the negative values of m. So they are always, the reflection coefficient is always smaller than 1. It's absorbed. And these ones are m equal 1, m equal 2. And you could have m equal 3 and so on, if you continue. And now the purpose is to do this, but on this experiment. This is just to present the team. We work with Silke van Fartner in Nottingham. We have, myself and 3 PhD students, and also 2 external collaborators that actively worked on this experiment. Ted Tedford, who is an engineer in fluid mechanics in Vancouver, who was actually working in the first experiment on the analog Hawking effect, and Mauricio Ricard, which is in Brazil. And this is sort of a picture of what you can see in the lab. So this is like a side view of the water tank. Here you have a camera system that records the free surface. I'll explain with a little bit more detail. And which can allow us to register the motion of the waves. All right. So again, this is a picture, but let me use this simple drawing just to fix the ideas. If you look from above, it's a tank, rectangular tank here. In the middle, you have a hole. On the side, you feed water with a pump, and you do it in such a way that the draining is stationary. So the water arrives, it rotates, it's drained into the hole into a lower tank, and then it's taken again in a pipe and refed here. On this side, we have a long plate that we can make oscillate with a certain frequency that we decide. So these generate waves that propagate on this vortex. And on the other side, we have an absorption beach. So it's simply a slope, which is quite a bit long. And by doing this, you will absorb the waves that arrives here, and they're not sent back into the system. So you sort of mimic an infinite system. All right, so the first question is to look a bit at the flow that we can obtain this way. So by setting the pump and waiting until we have a nice stationary flow, we can also obtain experimentally the velocity field. For this, we use this method named particle imaging velocimetry. It's just we sent a lot of very small paper dots, and we record how they move, and from this we can reconstruct the field, the velocity field of the water. So it's very simple. You see that this is the angular velocity as a function of the radius from the center of the hole. And you see that it increases. It roughly follows the ideal case until it gets too close to the core. So when you have this bump here is when you start being at this level here. You start, the free surface gets deformed, and then you become further away from the ideal model, but so you can use a slightly fancier model to try to capture this. I mean, none of them is really perfect, but it captures the idea that up to the point where the free surface gets deformed, this increases like 1 over r. Same for the radial velocity. And what we want to check is sort of if we are in the right regime where we expect super radians. But the tricky point is that we have to work with relatively deep water, so 6 centimeter, and it's deep with respect to the wavelength that we send. So we're not in this shallow water regime, but we're on the contrary on the deep water regime, so we have a lot of dispersion. So the propagation speed is changed a lot depending on which frequency you send. And in particular, because of this, the notion of horizon is a bit unclear because you no longer have a good description in terms of an effective space-time. But at least what we can do as a first estimate is to look at the group velocity, which captures the propagation speed of the waves. So in our case, it's about 0.2 to 0.3 meter per second. So you see that it's quite slow. And you can compare this velocity with the velocity of the background. And here you can see at least you have a group velocity horizon, a group velocity ergo region. And it seems that it works quite OK in the sense that the angular part is high enough to have an ergo region. And it seems, although, that we have a horizon because the radial velocity also increases, although the horizon seems to be located sort of inside the throat of the vortex, where it's much harder for us to measure properly. But at least seems that the velocities are high enough that we should hope to observe the super radiance effect that we're after. So let me point out the main condition, in fact, that we have checked are satisfied in our setup. First is the fact that the super radiant condition will be satisfied, all right? Because the angular velocity here increases at least to enough values to be bigger than the frequency, the range of frequency we can send with the wave generator. So that's the first important condition, because if we don't have this, there is absolutely no reason to expect super radiance. And the second important condition that we'll exploit is the fact that the flow is nicely symmetrical. So this is a two-dimensional plot of the amplitude of the water, and you see that it's approximately symmetric. And this is important because it allows us to make sure that if we have several azimuthal waves, they don't couple. And we have checked that, in fact, the residual asymmetry cannot induce an error on the reflection coefficient more than about 3%. So now how do we do with the experiment? In particular, how do we measure and register what's happening? Well, we have this very nice sensor, which works in a, so the principle is relatively simple. You have a projector, it projects a pattern on the free surface. And when you send wave, this pattern is deformed. And you register the pattern with two cameras. And from the deformation of the pattern, they can reconstruct exactly the free surface. So this is kind of the brute data that we have is a point cloud in 3D of the location of the free surface. Here you see that you have this wave propagating. And it was actually developed by the University of Nottingham in collaboration with a German company. So this is how it looks like when we do an experiment and register it. So this is actually now, this is actual data, it's not theory. Philippe, you have a question? So here it's on this side, sorry, it's reverse compared to the schematic, but on this side is the wave generator. It propagates this way. It scatters on the hole. And you see that the general shape of this is a plane wave. And then there is an interfering wave that comes out from the center. And it's this pattern that we have to analyze to see if there is extraction of energy. Yeah. So this is the same experiment. So we send this plane wave that scatters, and we can change the frequency with the wave generator. And this is the pattern that we observe. That there is a nice spin-off that comes out directly, is that you see here that there is some sort of topological phase, since that if you go around the vortex, you have more wavefront up than down. In fact, it was shown quite a while ago already that this wave here, phase, is analogous to the Aronoff-Bohm phase that you have when you send electrons around on a magnetic field. So how does this work, this analogy? You can show that if you have, so this is the theory, if you have wave propagating on the flow and you look only far away from the center, where precisely you're far away from the horizon, so you neglect the effect that we're interested in, you have a phase shift that has this shape, and in fact, it's perfectly analogous to the phase shift that arises in the Aronoff-Bohm effect, where the velocity fields plays the role of the vector potential of electrodynamics. Of course, it's less surprising because behind there is not this interpretational question, but at least the mechanism is the same, and you have this topological phase that we can see very nicely in this picture. But we can also see that it's really not only what we see. I mean, it's quite far from this stuff, because you have, in addition to this topological phase shift, we have this scattered wave that interferes with the incoming wave, incident wave, and it is hidden in this extra scattering. This is where the information that we're interested in is hidden, namely the reflection coefficient in the superradiance. So how do we extract this reflection coefficient from this pattern? Once we have those images, we apply two filters. So because we have really, in real time, the motion of the free surface. So first of all, we apply a frequency filter in frequency. So we make a time Fourier transform, and we pick up just a frequency that we send it with a wave generator. It has several advantages. First, it eliminates directly the background flow, the shape of the background flow, which is registered as well. But because it's stationary, it's at zero frequency, so you get rid of it. And you can also get rid of high harmonics because, of course, the wave generator, it's actually quite hard to make a plane wave experimentally. And you typically generate high harmonics, so twice the excitation frequency and so on. And if you can filter that, then it's no longer a problem, assuming that they don't interact, namely that it's linear to a good approximation. So this is the range of frequency we sent, about 3 hertz. So so at this level, we really have a single frequency wave, so a scattering mode. And this is actually, this drawing, they're already filtered in frequency. So we have this, and now we apply a second filter, which is we pick a center, and we make another Fourier transform, but in angular coordinate this time. And by doing this, depending on the value of m, we obtain the different profile for as if we sent a wave with a particular azimuth number. And what is quite nice, in fact, is that a plane wave, you can show that it's the superposition of all azimuthal wave for any of these numbers here. So theoretically, it's like we're doing the experiment many times with all different values of m. And it's a coherent superposition. And because the flow is symmetric, all these components, they don't interact with each other. So it's like independent experiment. Of course, in practice, we can only resolve up to the size of the system and the size of the camera resolution. So in practice, we can see about up to m equals 3.
And what is phi exactly? Phi is the surface?
Phi is the surface. The field is the surface elevation. Yeah. So here, this phi is it's the surface elevation after you apply a filter in frequency and a filter in m. And as again, it should decompose from the theory. When you look at least far enough from the center of the vortex, it should decompose into an incoming part and an outgoing one, a one to compare these amplitudes. So a few difficulties that you have to check. First, well, the center of the vortex is not so easy to pick correctly. So you have to look for the center of the symmetry of the background flow. So this is a zoomed. This is this part here, which is very close to the center. And you see little dots here, we try different position of the center to check that if we're off from a few pixels, it doesn't affect the end result. Because of course, if you do not pick the right center, these waves would have a completely different shape, and you can artificially have absorption or amplification. But we have checked that. We're close enough to the symmetry center, so it doesn't affect the result.
So
yeah.
You redid the analysis using each of those points as the center?
Yeah. What we did is we run a certain number of points, and we do statistics on it, and we look how the end result is affected. But it's very small in the end compared to other source of error. And the other point, which is quite important to look at, is the fact that what we run is not really an amplification in the heights of the free surface, in the surface elevation. It's what we run is really an amplification of energy. And this is not equivalent. I mean, it would be equivalent if we were in the perfect shallow water regime where it's analogous to a space-time. But because of dispersion, there is a difference between the energy amplification and the amplitude amplification. So it's not only the ratio between these two that we have to consider. So let me explain this a little bit. What we did is we defined the reflection coefficient as the energy flux of the wave. So the energy flux of what is coming in and the energy flux of what comes out. And this is what we want to compute and compare to the value 1 to see if we're energy extraction. And in fact, from the theory, we know that it's, of course, related in a linear theory. This energy flux is related to the square of the amplitude of the surface elevation. But it also depends on the propagation speed, the group velocity, and on this capital omega, which is the frequency in the frame of the fluid, so the co-moving frame. And this frequency is typically, because in the window where we observe the water is still flowing, although it's small, you still have a little bit of flow, and this introduces a Doppler effect. So in fact, this frequency can be shifted by the flow. And it will be shifted differently between the wave that goes in, which goes with the flow, and the wave that comes out, which goes against the flow. So there you have a little shift, which affects this term, and also this one, in fact, because if you change the frequency, you change the propagation speed. So this factor here is not the same for the incoming part and the outgoing part. So we have to to correct for it and to compute this prefactor to make sure that the coefficient we measure is really the ratio in energy. So this is what you obtain. So these are, again, this is data. So this is here. These are for different values of m, negative, zero, and positive, the radial profile. All right. So you have two waves. It's a real and imaginary part. And there should be, this here should be the superposition of incoming and outgoing waves. In fact, the continuous line is this superposition, is this fit. And the dots are the experimental points. So you see that it works pretty well. Actually, to obtain this fit, what we did is we simply took this profile and we make a Fourier transform. So these are the Fourier transform, and you see they have to have two peaks, which correspond simply to the incoming part and the outgoing one. And then we can look at the ratio between these two peaks, use the correction, the energy correction that I mentioned before, and we can extract the reflection coefficient, which is the ratio between the in and out amplitudes. All right, so here is the result. First, let me show you how it works for the best frequency, that is the frequency where we see the effect in the clearest manner. So first, this magenta point here has the reflection coefficient for different values of m. So we see that it looks pretty much like what we expect, namely that negative values of m are absorbed, actually significantly absorbed, lower than 1. Well, positive n, in fact, they're amplified. You're above 1. All right? And it's interesting to compare this not only to the value 1, but also what happens if you send a plane wave with the same frequency, but this time no vertex at all, no drain. So we put something on the hole, then the water is not flowing at all. It's just standing water. We send the same wave, and we make this decomposition, and we obtain the coefficient. And these are these points here. They are the points that we obtain when there is no vortex. And you see that, well, first, it doesn't depend on the value of m. This is expected because you have no background rotation. But what you observe, which was not taken into, which I didn't mention so far, is that, in fact, you have a fair amount of dissipation in the system when you propagate all along the tank. And in fact, you see that you dissipate quite a lot because you lose 20% of the energy of the wave along this propagation. But in fact, in some sense, it strengthens these results because it means that the amplification due to the extraction of the background is also able to beat what you would have lose just by propagating. Yeah?
So did you ever vary what you can think of as little omega, the frequency of your waves, so that the turn on would be at a high m or the super radiance turn on?
So this is the next slide.
Oh, okay, sorry.
I mean, no, first there is this slide, which is to explain the error bar here. So this error bar, we're taking into account the error due to the center, the energy correction that I mentioned. But in fact, most of this, and also the noise of the detection method. But all of this is very small, and the main contribution of this error bar is simply by running the experiment several times, trying to have the same background flow and to see how it varies, to see if the effect is robust. So we've done here 15 times the same experiment, and this is simply the standard deviation. This, right? So it seems that, it's hard to reproduce exactly the same value, but it's always amplified in every attempt that we did for this particular flow and this particular frequency. So now, I think it's what you wanted to ask. We have done this by scanning a little bit in frequency, namely between a little below 3 and a little above 4 hertz, and we see how this result is affected. So first, this is the evolution of the wave without vortex. So this is just to characterize dissipative effects, all right? And you see that for low frequency, you have almost no dissipation, and when you increase the frequency, it goes down quite a bit. And it's actually quite significant. And what we realize later is that, in fact, this dissipation is due to the fact that the water is not perfectly clean. It's not pure water. So you have typically dust at the surface. And the combination of dust and the fact that we have to put dye in the water to make it to have some color that the camera can register. And because of this, you have, in fact, a sort of resonance effect that occurs at 4 hertz. So at 4 hertz, it's sort of the worst frequency from dissipation. So it was a bit unlucky, but nevertheless, didn't prevent us from observing what we wanted. So these are now the variation of frequency for the three negative values of m. So when it's really negative, you see that it's absorbed for almost all frequencies when it's rotating against the hole. Sorry? No? Yellow is not very clear. So the yellow one is, the yellow one is m equals 0. And for m equals 0, you see that you have a transition from low frequency. It's elastically scattered. So m equals 0 is really circular waves. it goes in and it comes out with approximately the same energy. And then when you increase the frequency, it goes down, so it loses more and more energy. And it loses more that which you can explain just by dissipation. So it means that, in fact, it's really lost in the hole. And of course, what we're interested in is the positive values of m equal. So this is m equal 1, and this is m equal 2. And you see that it's sort of qualitatively, you recover the feature that I showed from the theory, namely that first the m equal 1 is amplified, and then it's absorbed, and then m equal 2 gets amplified a little later. And this seems to, and so in all, it seems that this spectrum looks like what we would expect from naive models, or at least qualitatively. So it seems that we have successfully observed this effect of amplification and extraction of rotational energy. So yeah, let me stop here. This is published in this paper with these gentlemen. And it shows that we are able to extract, by sending a wave with a certain structure, we're able to extract this rotational energy from the flow. And it sort of look like you would expect from at least naive models. Of course, we can only reproduce from this theory the qualitative behavior. And now what would be nice is to understand in more depth how to explain these values. In particular, they're actually quite high amplification if you compare to usual models. And it would be nice to understand this. And for this, we have to make a better model of the flow and take into account dissipation. So in a sense, on the theory side now, there is quite some work to do to be able to describe this more precisely. Thank you.
Yes, so on the last slide, is it clear whether that m equals 1 shutoff is because of the superradiance condition or just because of dissipative effects?
Yeah, no, it's not clear at all. It's obviously, it's a combination. So you have several effects, in fact, here. You have dissipation. You have also that when you change the frequency, the propagation speed changes. So at least in this naive description, it's like the ergo region is changing, the size of the ergo region is changing. So that will also affect the superradiant condition. So you have, and also just the superradiant condition. So all three mixes, and for now, we don't have precise model to be able to discriminate.
Can I ask a question about this graph? So it's kind of interesting that the frequency region where you see the kind of the best result is at a frequency where you see significant dissipation when you have steady vertex free flow. Whereas we go to low frequency, and if you look at the background curve, the blue one, which is the, I guess, is absorption without any vertex. So at low frequency, it seems that there's very little dissipation, but if you look at what happens when you put a vertex, it seems that the result is not very clear, right? So there's not very clear super radiance at low frequency.
I don't know, at low frequency, it's not that it's not clear. It's that it's clearly not super radiant at low frequency. Here it's not super radiant.
I
mean, yeah.
I see. So
here it's super radiant.
Yeah. Oh, even the peak position is not at low frequency. It's
sorry?
The position of the peak is not.
Well, not even here. I mean, if you look at the arrow bar, it's compatible with 1. So, and in fact, these are a bit absorbed for some reason.
Okay.
So at low frequency, but it's expected theoretically that low frequency would be. I mean, technically, if you look at a model without dispersion, without dissipation, as long as it's below this threshold, it should be superiorly amplified. But if it's 1% amplification, and then you have dissipation a little bit or any deviation, then, I mean, yeah, it's going to be just close to 1. So, but the superiorness we claim is for high enough frequency. Yeah?
So why the m equals 0, why does it get so strongly suppressed at high frequency?
So this is also expected from what you, from black hole models, if you want, because if you look at the effective potential for these waves from the hole to infinity, you have the centrifugal barrier, right? So at low frequency, in fact, everything happens that you're completely reflected on this centrifugal barrier. But if you increase the frequency high enough, in fact, you can go above it and you fall into the hole. So it's expected that when you increase the frequency, you get more and more absorbed. In fact, if you fix M and you send the frequency to infinity, it's always going to zero, because you always end up in the hole. You had a question?
In this idea of using fluid to mimic black hole, is there any possible analogy of the difference of vacuum between accelerating observer close to horizon and one at infinity? This difference of vacuum, like how you will see the physics in the fluid?
What do you mean? Because I'm not sure. What do you mean by difference of vacuum?
Okay.
Yeah.
Like they're related by the Birkhoff transformation.
Well, obviously, to hope to see quantum effects, it's not for us, at least so far, because water is a bit too hot for this. But mathematically, you can see. You can see this, but I'm not sure. If you refer to the Unruh effect of accelerating observer,
yes,
some people have worked on how you can make this in fluid. But I have to be honest, I don't really know how this works. For the Hawking effect, you can do this, and you can check that it corresponds to the local vacuum in the sense that by construction, the Hawking effect works if short wavelength are in their ground state. So this is what you... But I don't know if you can experiment. I mean, in principle, you could, but experimentally, I don't think they are able to actually probe this very short wavelength and check that they're actually in their vacuum. Except that the end result does work. So I don't know if that answers your question. Sorry.
So you mentioned that you are the deep water regime, and then the dispersion relations change. And this reminds me of kind of how Java-Lifshitz gravity. Is there an analogy to kind of modify gravity?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same question that would arise, in a Hawking-Lifshitz gravity. It's
Thomas is an expert at defining black holes in this case.
Yeah, but he haven't worked so much on effect like the Hawking effect, but... The difference with Hawking-Lifshitz gravity is that this high frequency term that affect the dispersion relation, they increase the propagation speed, and you really have two types of dispersion: whether it increases at short wavelength or it decreases. For water, it decreases, right? So in that sense, it's quite different. And when you study the Hawking effect, typically, I mean, for super radiance, I don't think it's extremely relevant, but for the Hawking effect, it changes quite a bit, because depending on the sign of this relation, the initial condition that you have to impose are either inside or outside the black hole. And the Hawking-Lifshitz is inside. So in fact, the main difficulty to understand this in Hawking-Lifshitz is to understand what happens inside. And then you have to build full solution of this equation. And they have new structure that appear with this universal horizon, which is supposed to be a horizon for infinitely fast modes. And the question is more, does this horizon changes the result? But it's and this structure a priori I don't see it happening in fluid. But
more generally, I mean, all these systems are non-electricity, so more.
Sorry?
So the systems in the end, they are non-relativistic and should
Sure, but I mean, by non-relativistic, I mean, if you mean the system, the atoms there, for sure, they're non-relativistic. But the waves, at least for long wavelength, they are relativistic.
Yeah,
I mean.
No, but I mean, you know, the limit, if you see the non-relativistic structure.
Sure, but it's a modification, but that occurs in the UV, if you want. I mean, or if not, it's like it becomes completely different from the Hawking effect, in fact.
What's the analogous of the spin parameter curve geometry? Like, how fast is your, or how fast would your black hole be spinning?
I'm guessing you don't want an answer in meter per second, but like,
No, yeah, like, is it maximum, you know?
But,
extreme,
so there is something,
or near extreme,
there is
not at all, or there is no difference.
A priori, no analogous of this maximally, of the extremal black hole. It's like, because then what fixes the shape of the effective geometry, which, at least in this kind of model, for example, then there is no restriction on the angular velocity and the radial velocity. So you can have you never reach so extremality in that sense. In a sense, we're very much extremal, in a sense that the rotation typically is much higher than this. So this coefficient is about more than 10 times bigger than this one. So and this, the drain parameter would be analogous to the mass, and the C would be analogous to the angular momentum. So it's high angular momentum in this respect. But it's not a problem, because in a flow, the solution doesn't show an equal singularity or some exotic stuff like this. I mean, you can increase the rotation as much as you want. Nothing special is going to happen. Does that answer your question?
Would you expect you said the horizon was well inside the throat of your fluid, so would you expect to see the horizon coming out of the throat a little bit?
If you increase the drain, yeah, it will come outside. Yeah. In practice, it's hard to do, because the drain starts being important when it's in the throat, because then water goes down, so you have gravity. But when it's flat, the drain is quite slow. So this is what happens this way.
So I should think of the free surface as the embedding of the curvature, or how would I that analogy with the space stuff?
Technically, the wave equation for the propagation works for if the free surface is flat. So if the free surface is bent, so typically in the throat, there is no. I don't know any equation that I've been carefully cooked up. So
the region is well outside.
The origin is well outside of the throat. And then the curvature comes just by the velocity. It's not curved in the. It's not spatially curved, if you want.
Can I ask a clarifying question related to that? I mean, this metric isn't the Kerr metric, right?
No, this metric is not the Kerr metric. It's a metric.
Some other metric.
Which has a horizon and an arc origin. It's not the Kerr metric. Actually, you can show that you cannot mimic the Kerr metric with these fluids. I mean, maybe if you use like very exotic features, but you cannot mimic the Kerr metric. You can mimic features of the Kerr metric. And the main features, at least for superradiance and Hawking radiation, are simply having a horizon and an ergo region. So it's
very quick question. Can you directly measure fluctuations without sending waves? The fluctuation of the surface in equilibrium without sending, in a steady state, without sending sound waves?
Sure, you can measure them. But it's obviously possible in the sense that this is what was done in this experiment in Poitiers, which they did for the Hawking effect. They were measuring just the noise and the fluctuation. But the question then becomes, what do you do with this fluctuation? Because if you just like it, it's random noise. So if you look at correlation, then you can extract some physics and some interesting
property.
So for this experiment, technically, we could do this. In principle, we could do it. We haven't done it. And I mean, you have the sensitivity has to be quite higher, because what is nice here is that you don't see this. You don't see the background noise here in this plot. You don't see the background noise because it's ridiculously small here. Here you have some noise, and you don't see it because it's super small compared to what we send. So at least here we have a very clean signal. But then if you want to extract data from the noise itself, it's a bit harder. But it can be done.
Slide near the end with the super radiant frequencies, and maybe your second last slide. What, like for m equals 2, what is the super radiant bound frequency given the parameters of your rotation? What would you expect to be the cutoff?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean,
and just the inequality on that.
The short answer is we don't really know, and this is why we've been careful with this, because we don't know, when we characterize the flow, we don't know precisely where is the horizon, and this condition, it has to be, so omega, this is the angular velocity, so v theta over r, it has to be evaluated at the horizon, but we don't know exactly where the horizon is, where you have a, sort of a big uncertainty. And also the propagation is more complicated, so we use this group velocity criterion, but this could affect exactly this condition. So it's hard to have a good estimate. I mean, we can have order of magnitude, this is what we did. Here, what we check is simply that if you follow this, it goes to high value enough and it's well above the frequency, or well above, I mean, significantly above the frequency, so that we should expect that we are in the superagent regime.
All the frequencies that you plotted should be
above that. But then it depends on M. No. Then it depends on M.
So right, that means say you fix M, but then all the frequencies in that plot.
So I guess the order of magnitude, the order of magnitude is a few hertz. So it's but you know we scan like a range of 1 hertz. So if you're off from 50%, it's like completely off our plot. If we're, and it's hard to estimate this with an error bar which is smaller than. So order of magnitude, yeah, it's above the. And here I don't know if you do this. Like you have 0.3, the horizon is about 1 centimeter. That would mean omega is, you have to divide by 2 pi. So it's about 7, I guess. If I do it this way, very naively, it could be 7 hertz.
Okay, so then everything should be super radiant.
Everything should be super. Well, of course you have dissipation.
Yeah.
But this condition, yeah. But again, I mean, we've been very careful with this because we cannot really have a value for this because we don't have enough information or enough precision. Yes?
I mean, I guess for this experiment, it's nice to have the absorption beach or something to not get it reflected back onto the black hole. But what happens if you don't put that beach? Would you actually see, you know, like this black hole bone kind of thing in your experiment? Or not?
Oh yeah, so that's, well, it could be.
Or
I mean, in principle,
put, like another resonator next to it, so when you get this wave, you know, it bounces back without like, a good.
Yeah, if you have a hard wall, essentially everything comes back in the system.
Yeah.
So in principle, yeah, you should observe instability if you have super agents plus a trapping boundary. We haven't really studied this, except that, I mean, by rapidly doing the experiment without a beach, we didn't see an instability, but I have to say that, again, there is a lot of dissipation. Dissipation will sort of kill the effect, because you have to make sure that you're amplified, you go to the boundary, you come back in, and the dissipation of all this propagation doesn't kill the amplification. Otherwise, this self-amplified mechanism would just be killed. So, yeah.
Do you consider using other fluids that might have less dissipation? Better parameters?
Yeah, that's a possibility. But what we're going so far is not reaching, because if you look at the theory for pure water, the viscosity of water and dissipation should be relatively small, in fact. So what we see here is not really pure water effect. As I mentioned, it's due to dust at the free surface, it's due to the fact that we put stuff in the water. So what we try now is to work to make sure that the surface is very clean when we run an experiment. And hopefully if we change the detection method, we can also maybe get rid of whatever we have to put inside the water. If you do this carefully, you could reduce the damping like quite significantly. That would be, I guess, a simpler method than using another fluid. I mean, first I have to say I have no idea which fluid I would use, and I mean it's pretty big this stuff. So I mean, water is not too expensive, but if you want to fill with some, you know, fancy chemicals, it's going to cost a lot.
So how big is the bathtub?
It's 3 meter over, slightly smaller, but 3 meter over 1.5, and 6 centimeter deep.
And the black hole size is 2 centimeters in diameter.
The radius of the hole, so essentially, which is close, No, actually, yeah, the radius of the hole is 2 centimeters, and the estimate as a, like, the order of magnitude estimate is 1. Yeah, well, it's about the, it's a bit inside. The hole is 4 centimeters, the diameter.
Thank you.